Hello again, this is Rabbi Jeff Sacks of Atid and the Web Yeshiva with another installment in our series on Jews, Judaism, and modernity. Welcome back to everyone. My apologies for the interruptions in our normal broadcasting schedule. Last week we had Shiva Osir B'Tammuz. I was preoccupied with a family simcha. We made a bar mitzvah for our oldest son. I think that kept me away from you for a week. When last we met, we'll just have a quick refresher. Thanks for all the mazel tovs. Okay. A quick refresher. We were talking about Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. We had been talking about the advent of the Reform movement in Germany and in Europe, and then we were talking about the Orthodox response to the Reform movement. We talked a little bit about the Chatam Sofer. And then we started discussing the work and life and accomplishments of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. When last we left off, we were looking at his 19 letters, actually the 17th of his 19 letters. I had mentioned that this was his, I believe, his earliest published work, a very influential work. 17 essays on topics of interest to contemporary Judaism, written in the guise of these letters, the epistolatory convention of writing, instead of freestanding essays, in the form of purported responses to questions from a young, inquisitive, intelligent young man about issues related to Judaism. I mentioned in passing that this is a kind of literary convention that many people who wanted to write popular philosophy employed over the centuries, over the years, either actual real letters to actual questioners or purported letters. The most well-known 20th century example would be C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, which are of course fictionalized. But the idea of writing in this form makes it much more engaging. Even think, perhaps not on the philosophical side, but on the halachic side, there are two general modes of writing halachic works. One is to write freestanding halachic psokim and analyses on different topics. The other is, of course, the very popular and long-standing genre of shutim, of shelot v'tshuvot, question and answers, which are actually, of course, in most cases, actual questions that poskim receive, and their responses. And we have the genre of shutim, of course, goes back to the early medieval period, and even earlier in some cases. We have tshuvot from the Gaonim, from the very, very earliest of the medieval period, or even late antiquity. There's something interesting about them. There's something interesting just thumbing your way through collections of tshuvot, of shelot v'tshuvot, of questions and answers. Even sometimes just to look at the questions alone is interesting. And of course, shelot v'tshuvot, because they're written in this very case-specific style, often offer up very interesting historical works. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University a number of years ago wrote an interesting book in Hebrew. I don't believe it's available. I'm certain it's not available in English, called Shelot v'tshuvot k'makor historii. Response to literature as a source for history, for historical study, that goes through this question with some very very interesting examples. Let me just look at the chat. Tilalei asks, are there poskim who cast their essays in the guise of questions and answers, even if they have to make up the questions themselves. I'm sure there have been. I know that there's some contemporary rabbis working in the field, particularly in this realm of a realm which I'm not uncritical of, called the Shut SMS. Where you can send in on SMS a question and you can get an answer by SMS, and these then get sometimes published in the weekend in the weekend SMS is text messages. I don't know what SMS stands for. If somebody can post it, I don't know, but text messages on a cell phone, where you can text message a question and get sometimes an immediate response. Now, this, I guess, is a very handy format if your question is, what bracha do you make on whatever it is that you're about to eat? But some other topics really require, Alan writes, it's SMS is for short message service. Usually it's what is it, 140 characters? It has to be a very short kind of thing that you can chat back and forth on the cell phone. There's certain questions which can't really be dealt with in those contexts, and yet it seems to me that they often are. In all cases, back to our topic of this letter of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch about reform. There are actually two of the 19 letters deal with the topic of reform. We were in the midst of this one. It's this very, it's a sophisticated response to the critique that the reform movement was making on Judaism, on Orthodoxy, with a candid admission that there is a need for change. We are not opposed to the idea of change. And the hardcore, hard line that says nothing can be changed is not correct, admits Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. But he questions, where do you point the finger? What is it that is in need of reform? I hope this is familiar. I hope that most of you had a chance to look through this. Yourself, he makes this very clear statement, merely to seek greater ease and comfort in life through the destruction of the eternal code, meaning the Torah, set up for all time by the God of eternity, is not and never can be the reform which we need. Judaism seeks to lift us up to its own high plane. We must never attempt to drag it down to our level. We are in need of reform, but it's not the halakha, it's not the halachic system, and it's not the Torah itself that's in need of reform. I think that we were around here. To remain within the fold of Judaism, but of a Judaism which is sadly misunderstood, and to confine one's efforts to the modification of the external form of a part of Judaism that is not properly understood, to remodel the divine service, to remodel the prayer service, to remodel the synagogue rituals in accordance with the demands of an age, to substitute for things misunderstood and therefore abolished other things that are equally uncomprehended. Is that the reform we desire? So he's making an admission that there are certain things about religious life that are probably foreign to the contemporary Jew, that are misunderstood or misrepresented, and we need to fix that, and we need an educational campaign to do that, but not by tearing down, but by building up. As for the training, the religious training of the young, the education, which should be the bearer of all our hopes for the future, how does it fare? Our religious schools are like all other institutions of learning of the present day. Our young are made thoroughly capable of contending vigorously in the struggle for livelihood. The trades, commerce, the arts, and the sciences, all these are carefully inculcated and the mind developed. although even in this regard more attention is paid to the mere training of the memory than to the cultivation of habits of thought. He's making a critique about general education as well, but of course you'll notice here, if you compare this to our conversation of quite a while ago about religious life on the eve of the appearance of, let's say, Moses Mendelssohn, he's taking it for granted that Jews should be educated secularly, that people should learn a trade, that people should have careers, they should have work, they should be trained in trade, commerce, arts, and sciences. But what about the education of the heart, the cultivation of Judaism? Where is the school that is imbued with the Jewish spirit so that this spirit may also inspire the lives of its students? I mean, you know, we could be talking about, you know, today. This is written probably, you know, a little less than 200 years ago. But these critiques on the state of Jewish education are still, to a certain degree, ring true. What about the rearing of human beings who will see themselves as creatures living in a divine world and endowed with powers belonging to God, which they are to dedicate to the fulfillment of God's will? Where are the young men and women who will rejoice in their mission and who will be imbued with fiery love for the name Jew, Jewish pride, which summons them to such a way of life, to fulfill the divine law amidst perils, sufferings, and privations, who comprehend the world, the past, the present, and themselves as cornerstones in the edifice of the future? This is how are we going to educate people to make this, to lead the committed lifestyle? Take one of the religious textbooks in your hand, and what will you find there? I'm not certain exactly which books he's singling out here. But you may find some principle of life drawn from outside of Judaism, the 13 creeds upon which Judaism may indeed stand. Here he's referring, of course, to the Rambam. But which certainly is not all there is to Judaism. So this is, you take some book of religious doctrine. I mean, and we can think of endless examples. You might be able to even like look on your own shelves and point an indicting finger. You know, books that purport, you know, in 40 or 50 or 60 or 100 pages to represent the Jewish view on, right? Any book that the title of which is, you know, the Jewish view on, or blank, 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 the authentic Jewish view, is by definition going to be a gross oversimplification. Even if it gets it right, and there are plenty of books that don't get it right, but even if it gets it right, it's only ever going to be able to give you one small slice of anything, and altogether you should always be suspicious of anything that purports to be the Jewish view. By definition, there's rarely, or there are very, very few things about which we can speak so monochromatically. So he says, take one of these books, and you know, you'll find a discussion of some topic, but you'll misunderstand it. You'll completely get it wrong. If you take the example that we've spoken about in the Rambam course, for those of you that learn with us on Thursday nights, imagine a Martian lands on Earth and doesn't know anything at all about Judaism. But give him, you know, a dozen, I don't know, art scroll books or the like that purport to be the Jewish view on, and from this he's going to try to extrapolate what Judaism really is all about. Well, he'll get a lot right, but he'll also get a whole lot wrong. And the proportions will be all wrong, and the nuances will be wrong. Even if the details are correct, it'll be a real, it'll be like a picture of something put together by a blind man, carving together the spare parts and trying to come up with something elegant. It's not going to be. You may discover a few moral principles deduced from the Ten Commandments with the, hold on a second, with the Chukim and Edot either entirely ignored or else mentioned only in passing in the appendix. So you're going to find something which is, look at these books. What do they purport to be? They're going to be things that kind of highlight the ethical teachings of Judaism. The Ten Commandments, the great big moral lessons that Judaism has taught the world. But it's going to skip over lots of things, particularly the nitty-gritties, the halachot and the details and the kind of day-in and day-out, Oruch Chaim Yoredeya types of things, as the so-called ceremonial law. It is all more or less the reflection of a catechism which originated upon quite a different soil and for entirely different purposes. Or we may find taught the merest mechanical knowledge of the Torah, sometimes not even that. Think of these halachic handbooks. Somebody was just telling me about one the other day. Something kehilchata. I forget. One of these books, that takes some very, very narrow area of halacha. Imagine Hagbo and Glila Kehilchata, and you write a whole book. There might very well be such a book for all I know. Maybe it's even two volumes, one for Hagba and one for Glila, and you write a 600-page book about each. I just got as a present a big fat book. It's actually very nice. It's like a coffee table book because of all of the very many pictures in it, but it's the halachot and the minhagim of visiting the Kotel. I wouldn't have thought that there's enough material there to write a whole book, let alone one that weighs quite a few pounds. But apparently you can take any kind of small topic and write a whole book about it. And that's also going to distort. Now, one is a distortion because you only focus on love thy neighbor as thyself. And you kind of miss out the fact that Judaism is about certainly that, but lots of other things. And the other is the exact opposite, the polar extreme opposite. As for the duties, they are merely taught for practice in the most superficial manner, but without the slightest understanding or spiritual fervor, which would ensure their comprehension or attention throughout life. So if you learn halacha, the dry halacha, without spiritual fervor, so then it's going to be empty, and it's not going to be something which is going to be deeply understood or spiritually rich, and it's certainly not going to be something which is going to achieve lifelong retention. Whence, in the name of heaven, shall Jews then come? Jews who are inspired with the living spirit of the knowledge of God and their mission, and girded with strength to do battle against sensuality and error, against the troubles and the errors of the times. So you certainly can't rely on books, says Rav Hirsch. But why dwell upon this gloomy picture? Let us rejoice with at least Israel's young, that at least Israel's young are not inferior to others as regards intellect and morality, even though they are far removed from the ideals of Judaism. So he says, look, we have a lot. First of all, one of the things that jumps off the page here is this emphasis on youth, on young people, and this attention to really try to make a statement about what we can and should be doing for Jewish youth. So he says, even though Jewish youth are unfortunately deprived of certain knowledge, they're missing the ideals, but yet they still have intellect and they have morality. And that's something we can work with. That's pretty good raw material. Young people with intellect and young people with morals. So he says, let us rejoice at the activity going on within Judaism, even though much of it may be destruction or the whitewashing of rotten parts. It constitutes a pledge that better times are sure to come. And he strikes this really incredibly optimistic note when most people were seeming very pessimistic. We'll see in a little bit. Some really dire pessimism about where Judaism was going. But but Rav Hirsch is marked always by an optimism that Judaism and Halachic Judaism and Torah Judaism has an integrity all its own, that if we can reform what needs to be reformed, not reform Halacha, not reform Judaism, but reform education and reform our ability to communicate the message, then there's nothing to fear. And we can encounter the modern world and we can remain true to our ideas and our ideals and our values, and this will not be a threat. When Rav Hirsch was writing this in the early mid 19th century, it probably seemed that he was out of his mind. It's probably seemed either extraordinarily naive or Pollyanna-ish. Most Jews, even observant Jews, would not have imagined that 150 years later, 160 years later, that Torah true Judaism, that Orthodox Judaism, would be as strong as it is today, with all of our problems, would not have imagined that. And remember, it's significant to note that Rav Hirsch was not placing his eggs in the basket of Zionism, the notion that, well, things will get better when we go back and have our own country and our own sovereignty, and that was not his thing. For all of the reasons that we discussed earlier, the Sanhedrin and Napoleon and the emancipation and what it meant to live in a host community as a newly emancipated, as a part of the newly emancipated Jewish community. But nevertheless, there's this optimism in Rav Hirsch, which is just striking. It's palpable, and particularly optimism for the young. It constitutes a pledge that better times are sure to come. That is the end of this letter. So we see this admission that there is room to change, there's room to improve, there's a need to improve, but that reform has to come on the educational plane. It has to be directed at the young. We have to maximize those assets and those talents, and that's really summarizes the view of what Rav Kook was doing, the neo-orthodoxy, the so-called neo-orthodoxy of Rav Kook, and the response to the challenge of the reform movement. Now, parenthetically, since we're talking about the responses of Jewish responses to the modern condition, and just by way of contrast to Rav Hirsch, a brief discussion of what was known as the Wissenschaft des Judentums movement. In the early 19th century, we see the development of a new form of Jewish study, of Jewish scholarship. And there was a sense that the scientific study, the academic study of Judaism, not conventional Talmud Torah, not the Jewish study of the Beit Midrash, but the Jewish study of the university. Now, it's impossible for us to imagine. Now, in every university in North America, virtually, there are departments of Jewish studies. This was not always the case. But the study of Judaism as a scientific endeavor, as an academic endeavor, there was an idea that this would lead to greater acceptance of Judaism in the non-Jewish world, a sense that the intolerance of Jews and Judaism grows out of in ignorance of what Judaism is all about Judaism's history, its contribution to Western society. And there was a notion that if there'd be a kind of scholarly or secular scholarly scholarship and research in Jewish history, in literature, culture, that without, again, without the so-called restraints of studying it from within a belief system, that would alleviate some of those misinterpretations and misunderstandings and would have a positive effect. So in 1819, we see the foundation of the Verein für Kultur und der Wissenschaft des Judentums. I have in the past apologized for my German pronunciation, but it's the Society for the Society for the Study of the Culture and the Wissenschaft, the scientific study and writing on and about Judaism, and with a certain notion that that Judaism was going through a radical change. Conventional, traditional Judaism, the so-called Orthodox Judaism, was soon to be a thing of the past, and we needed to, in the words of Moritz Steinschneider, we needed to give it a proper burial. We needed to preserve it as a museum piece, as it were. And the academic study of Judaism would become the repository of understanding what historical Judaism had been. Leopold Zuns, here's good old Leopold, 1794 to 1886, who was initially actually aided by Heinrich Heine, who himself, of course, later converted, founds this Society for the Study of Judaism. And this, as a society, as an organization, it was later disbanded. It was later disbanded. It only exists for a number of years, from, I think, 1819 to the mid-1820s, when it became clear that it was not influencing Christian thought. But its main impact was on its way of thinking about and evaluating Judaism. Many of the members of the society converted to Christianity. I think that I a number of times have mentioned this wonderful book called by Amos Elon called "The Pity of It All," which is a portrait of German Jewry. And the degree to which people converted, you know, merely out of convenience, not out of conviction, is a very telling portrait. So there's various works that come out of this movement, analyses of rabbinic literature, of Bible, languages, of the study of Hebrew, the study of other, of Aramaic, etc. And it's an attempt to kind of break down traditional study with a new attempt to kind of, you know, not studying Torah, not studying Judaism, but studying about Judaism, again, in order to kind of package it as, you know, as a memorial to what Judaism was. There's a sense that, you know, it's the last generation, it'll be the last generation of observant Jews, and therefore there won't be any more halachic literature, let's say. So you see the writing up of these compendiums of of rabbinic literature, trying to classify all of Jewish civilization and culture under the headlines and the formats and the categories of general European or Christian scholarship. So you see the study of Judaism historically, philologically, philosophically, the music of the Jews, the literature of the Jews, the science of the Jews, the ethics of the Jews, biography. These are the types of works that come out, and these are the early works of academic Jewish writing. Geiger, Abraham Geiger, the granddaddy of the Reform movement, himself also gets involved in the Wissenschaft movement, in the academic study of Judaism, to show that the reforms that they're calling for should be based upon objective criteria drawn from scientific research. And there's an attempt to bring in modern critical research methods to traditional Jewish studies. Among the great pillars of this is Heinrich Graetz, or Zvi Graetz. If you ever come to visit us in the Web Yeshiva office, which is next to the President's House in Yerushalayim, around the corner from the Jerusalem Theater, we're two blocks away from Rehov Graetz. Rehov Graetz is a street that's it's right at the end of Emek Rephaim, for those of you that that know. There's a, in that neighborhood in Talbiya, there are a lot of streets named after the great early generation of Jewish historians. So you have Rehov Graetz, you have Rehov Pinsker, you have Rehov Dubnov, etc. Graetz writes this massive encyclopedic work, The History of the Jews from Ancient Times to the Present. I am sure that you can buy them on Amazon, etc. I mean, it's I'm sure it costs a lot of money too. But Graetz has this idea that, you know, we can put in one encyclopedic collection the entirety of the history of the Jewish people. I mean, we don't really write Jewish history this way anymore. These kinds of, you know, encyclopedic collective, you know, telling of all of Jews. I don't mean like an encyclopedia. Not the Encyclopedia Judaica, for example, is not trying to do this. That's a proper encyclopedia, meaning you'll find articles about everything that some editorial board assumed was appropriate to include in an encyclopedia. Here we're trying to write one long sweeping scope. It took him 25 some odd years to publish the whole thing, and it's the major work of Jewish history to come out from this period. It's written, of course, originally in German, and then translated into Hebrew and English and etc. There's also, I think, a condensed version of it into a couple of volumes, because nobody can read all 13 volumes. There were also seminaries, rabbinical seminaries, and academic institutions that were founded in order to serve as research facilities. In other words, not just to train rabbis, or not just to produce Talmidei Chachamim. Alan sent us the link for the one-volume abridged edition in English by Graetz for sale on Amazon for $28.97. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, recommend it. And if you're going to buy a book of Jewish history, this probably is not it. It's so outdated at this point. But if you're a serious student of Jewish history, so it certainly would have a place on your shelf, assuming that you had lots of other books of Jewish history on your shelf. But if you're only looking for one volume, this may not be it. So there were again, there were institutes and seminaries that were established to serve as these kinds of research facilities, in addition to training rabbis. And the notion that a rabbi would be more than what he was conventionally trained to be, but he would also be a researcher in Jewish studies. Someone asks, if you were looking for one volume, what might it be? That's a tricky question, because any one, this goes back to what Rav Hirsch said earlier about the problems with books. Any book that in one volume tries to encapsulate the entirety of Jewish history is going to be so, you know, I mean, just impossible. There are a few attempts. There's a book by Ben Sasson, Chaim Hillel Ben Sasson, called... well, you know, why don't we walk over to my... Oh, there you go. Alan, pretty good. The History of the Jewish People by Chaim Hillel Ben Sasson. That's a fairly good... that's a fairly good one-volume survey. History of the Jewish People by Ben Sasson. It's a fairly good one-volume history of, you know, what they call Mitanach ad Palmach, from, you know, biblical times up to the early modern state. It's not without its problems, but it's a pretty good one-volume. It's often used in a university course that's going to try to do a survey of the entirety of Jewish history. That might be a textbook that would be used. It's probably better to build a library of books topically based upon your interests in Jewish history. Jewish history, again, is conventionally broken down into three periods for the purposes of study. The classical period, which is from antiquity up to the end of Bayit Sheni, the end of the Second Commonwealth, or perhaps a bit later, let's say antiquity through Chazal. Let's say up to around the year 900 CE, which is the Tkufat HaGaonim, medieval Jewish history, which runs from there around the year 900 or around the year 1000, the beginning of the period of the Rishonim, up to the modern period. Where the modern period begins is a tricky question. If you recall, our very first session together dealt with that question, but probably someplace in the 17th century, latest 1800. You know, probably 17th, early 18th century would begin the modern period, which of course goes up to the contemporary time. At a certain point, you have to say, well, we can't talk about that historically because we're still living it. And where that point is might also be a matter of debate. Within any of those periods, you would probably find a few good books that deal with different topics. Maybe before we're done, we can go over there, and maybe not tonight, but before we're done, we can take a little walk through my Jewish history section of my own bookshelf, and I can make some recommendations of books. This question of the optimism of Rav Hirsch versus the inherent pessimism of the Wissenschaft movement, it comes to mind with a little anecdote I heard not long ago. There was a sociologist by the name of Marshall Sklar, or I think it's pronounced Sklar, S-K-L-A-R-E, Sklar was a professor at Brandeis. I think he died in the 90s, in the early 90s. He was one of the founders of Jewish sociology. And he made a prediction in the 1950s that in a generation from now, observant Judaism, traditional Judaism, won't exist. When he made this prediction, again around 1950, he wasn't saying it. He wasn't. He wasn't happy about the prediction. He wasn't pleased to say that Orthodox Judaism would disappear, although he himself was not Orthodox. He was making a sociological prediction, which, like it or not, seemed to be a very reasonable prediction at the time. Orthodoxy in the United States was on the ropes. I remember Rav Teitz of Elizabeth, New Jersey, Rav Pinchas Teitz, Zichrono Levracha. Those of you that I know, some of you must study with our friend Rabbi Yitzhak Blau. His grandfather was Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, who was one of the great, great Rabbonim in the United States. He was rabbi in Elizabeth, New Jersey. I grew up in the town next to Elizabeth, New Jersey, so I knew it very well. He had a very unique community. It was a European style shul, community rather, where the rabbi was the rabbi of the town, not merely the rabbi of the synagogue. So if there was more than one synagogue in town, which there was certainly at a certain point, he was the rabbi. He was the rabbi of all the Jewish, the Orthodox Jewish affairs in town. And he the school, the yeshiva, the day school, the elementary school, the high schools, high school for boys, high school for girls, they were all under the auspices of this one umbrella organization. The kashrus in town was under that umbrella. The eruv in town was under that umbrella. The mikveh in town was under that umbrella. It was a European style shul, and his was really the first serious Orthodox community in the suburbs. Prior to his arrival in Elizabeth in the 1930s, I think, there was no significant Orthodox community in any suburban town. There was, of course, in New York, in Chicago, in Boston. Rabbi Soloveitchik had arrived in Boston and started the Maimonides School, which in those days itself was also just a very, very small little school. And when Rav Teitz went to Elizabeth, he went to Elizabeth because his father-in-law had been the rabbi of the small community there, and he became the rabbi because he married the rabbi's daughter, and his father-in-law passed away, and he inherited the job. I once heard him tell a story that in Elizabeth, there were balabatim, there were members of the community, who on Friday night would make kiddush on challah. The halacha is if you don't have wine for some reason, you can make kiddush instead of holding a glass of wine, you make it over the two challot for Shabbat. That's on Friday night. And Shabbat morning, if you don't have wine, you make kiddush on schnapps. Why did they do this? Because they were mechallelei Shabbat. They'd go to work on Shabbat. In those days, the selections of kosher wines were very limited. Without going into all the details, I hope this is familiar to you. If not, I'll be happy to stay on afterwards and explain some of the finer details. But the wine was not mevushal. It was unpasteurized wine. And the halacha is that if a mechallel Shabbat, if a non-Sabbath observer, if a Sabbath desecrator touches the wine, it becomes forbidden to drink it. So they wouldn't drink their own wine because they knew that they were mechallel Shabbat. And if they touched their own wine, they were unable to drink it. So they would make kiddush on a Friday night on the challah and Shabbat morning on schnapps. Now that's why were they mechallel Shabbat? Because they felt, correctly or incorrectly, that if they didn't go to work on Shabbat,
on come Monday morning, they wouldn't have a job. So they were people that were mechallel Shabbat, not out of rebellion and not out of lack of commitment, but because that's the way it was in America in a certain era. And they had an early minyan. They had an early minyan on Shabbat morning. People would get up at 7 o'clock or 6:30, wherever it was. They'd go to shul, and then they'd go off to work. They didn't have a choice. In 1950, that was describing the situation in 1930s. In 1950, it was even worse, because people wholesale were giving up on Judaism. I mean, if you've ever read any Philip Roth, I mean, you have a sense of what Jewish life was like. Even though there was perhaps a very high ethnic identification, there was no ritual commitment. So in the 1950s, in the early 1950s, to say that Orthodoxy would be dead, it would be a museum piece in one or two generations, it seemed like a very reasonable bet to take, even if you were sad to take the bet. That's the pessimism of the Wissenschaft movement. The optimism of Rav Hirsch is borne out by the fact that I heard very recently that Marshall Sklar, the person that made this prediction in 1950, he has a great-grandson that today is learning in the Beis Medrash in Lakewood. I don't have independent confirmation of this, but I heard this anecdote to be true. And if it's not true, it could be true. I think that you see that despite all of the challenges that still face Judaism today, the pessimism, neither the pessimism of Marshall Sklar nor the pessimism 100 years earlier, 120 or 30 years earlier of the Wissenschaft movement, thank God neither of them have been fulfilled. The optimism of Rav Hirsch and the courageous leaders and teachers and rabbis that came after him is the one that really seems at this point to have carried the day, with the candid admission that there is a need for reform, not the reform of breaking down Judaism, but the reform of making improvements, primarily in Jewish education, but across the board in how Judaism is understood and perceived and communicated to its adherents. And that, I think, that the contrast between these two orientations is very stark indeed. It's interesting, just as a side note, to go back to the example of Rav Teitz and Elizabeth. Today, you know, in a lot of shuls, they have a hashkoma minyan. They have a minyan that meets early, and it's a sign of your seriousness and your frumkeit that you go to shul on Shabbat morning at whatever time hashkama is, at 7 or 7:30 or whatever it is, and you don't go to the main minyan. Why? Because the main minyan, which maybe starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, sometimes in the winter doesn't make Sof Zman Kriyat Shema in time. And if you want to have a higher hakpada and commitment and the level of ritual observance, you'll go to the early minyan, and because after all, the early minyan is gonna daven on time, and you won't have any problems of saying Kriyat Shema on time, and then you'll have time in the morning. You can learn the Daf Yomi, you can do other things, but that, of course, it's come full circle, because when the Hashkama Minyanim were started, they were started to accommodate the people that were then Mechal Shabbat. There were people that would then, you know, after davening on Shabbat morning, getting up and making the sacrifice to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to daven, they'd get on the trolley and go down to work because, again, they felt they didn't have a choice. And if they didn't on Monday morning, they'd be out of work. When the Young Israel movement got going in America in the mid-century, one of their ideas was that you could only be a young Israel shul if you davened at 9 o'clock. Because if you davened at 9 o'clock on Shabbat morning, that meant you were really frum. That meant that you weren't going to be mechallel Shabbat. That meant that you weren't then going to go to work afterwards. So it's kind of funny, or it's ironic, or that it's come full circle. That now there's this kind of notion that the people that get up for Hashkama, they're the shtarkers, they're the really serious ones. When in fact, the origins of these two minyanim, in certainly in North America, were the exact opposite. So that's one of the ironies of history, of course, is that everything always ends up coming around to be exactly the opposite. Okay, we will continue. We will continue next week, and I wish you all a pleasant evening.